Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Juliette Frumholt, sitting in for Jerry Kenny. This week, Sarah Buckingham tells us about Juneteenth celebrations in the Miami Valley. We'll hear about a symphony coming to CD that has local connections. But first, this week, the Dayton Public Schools approved the elimination of nearly 300 positions as they tried to balance their budget for next year. In an interview with Superintendent Lori Ward, Emily McCord began by asking what the impact will be from those cuts.
Currently, that's very hard to gauge. As you know, our reductions were right at the end of the year. So when you say the most impact, we did not eliminate massive programs or multiple programs. What we did do is we went through a process called zero-based budgeting, whereby we built the district based upon the requirements defined by the Ohio Revised Code, our collective bargaining agreements, and our special programming. Then we added on to our special programming. The largest work group that is reduced is the number of teachers.
In any particular curriculum, or is it just pretty much across the board?
It's just what is defined as a teacher. That could be an early childhood teacher. It could be a high school teacher. We did not attack programs. We just looked at the district and we said, how many PK-8 teachers do we need based upon the number of PK-8 students we serve? How many high school teachers do we need based upon the number of high school teachers we serve? So that was the thinking.
But I would imagine that when you're having cuts, even if it is happening across the board, it must still have an impact on some level.
The only way you can judge the impact is when you see it in operation. We won't see it in operation until school starts in August. I will tell you this. Some people will say you will see larger class sizes, but we will not violate our contract with the Dayton Education Association, which we have a defined class size in that particular collective bargaining agreement. So if you look at Dayton Public Schools and you see a particular language arts class, say at the ninth grade level, that might have had 15 students in it before, it could be at the literally now at the contract maximum based upon the Dayton Education Association contract.
And the Dayton Education Association, that's the union that you all work
with. Correct. Correct.
So the reason behind these cuts, is that mostly state and local government cuts?
We had, when we went through the whole process, we realized that we had to take about $9 million out of the biennium budget, which is the budget for the next 2 years. In the process of education, the treasurer does what is called a five-year forecast, which is submitted in May, and it includes the next five fiscal periods, beginning July 1, 2011. But when that was done, what went into that is we realized we had a loss of revenue from the stimulus fund. We actually also will see a loss of revenue from the tangible personal property tax, which was a phase out, and also a reduction in property tax collections, which is a little bit over $20 million.
So will these cuts solve the problem for next year?
Well, you know, this has been a really tough year for us. We eliminated 296 positions, not people, positions. What happened because of attrition, retirements, resignations, and so forth, on Tuesday, we actually announced the layoff of 179 employees. Now, we would hope that's based upon projections of a certain amount of revenue into this district. If anything changes, if the state budget, Emily, becomes less than what we're projecting, or we have a reduction in property taxes, then who knows? We will have to continually to look at the budget.
And when you're looking at the future, is there anything that you could see that could help the situation?
If we could find a way to constitutionally fund public education in Ohio, that would be most helpful. We need to really look at how public education, education in general, is funded in the state of Ohio. Because if we are not careful, we will create a system of have and have-nots.
That was Dayton Public Schools Superintendent Lori Ward speaking to WYSO's Emily McCord. You're listening to WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO.
Welcome to Politics Ohio. I'm Emily McCord. Today, I'm speaking with Martin Gottlieb. He's on the editorial staff at the Dayton Daily News. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So this week, the Senate passed its version of the state budget, and a notable difference is that there were changes to the Jobs Ohio plan. Can you explain first what happened there?
Well, that was kind of striking because the Jobs Ohio was enacted earlier in the year, very shortly after the legislature first convened, at the governor's urging, and there was really nothing to be done on it in the budget bill. But the Kasich administration is having second thoughts about the structure of it under certain pressure, under certain criticisms, and it's itself submitted about 10 amendments to the bill. The primary one being that under the new arrangement, the governor would no longer be the chairman of the committee, would not even sit on the committee that runs Jobs Ohio, this private-public partnership that would be awarding money to promising businesses. Some critics had said that that would be blatantly unconstitutional, and they seem to have backed off on that.
So this was one of the main ideas that Kasich's administration's put forth. So what impact does that kind of change have?
Well, it's unclear to me exactly how much impact it will have. I get, you know, the money is still there. This is not a decision to put less money into the project. I guess that it diminishes Kasich's power to direct where the money goes. But still, he will be appointing the members of this committee that runs Jobs Ohio. So whether much changes concretely remains to be seen.
Another one of Kasich's main thrusts has been Senate Bill 5, and you wrote an article on the phenomenon that the public doesn't support that effort. What are you finding?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I think that a lot of people have been very surprised by the polls since before all this happened, there was a widespread feeling that support for unions was waning. Certainly union membership was waning, and people were blaming them for a lot of things, not only in the realm of public spending and taxes, but in the realm of the collapse of the auto industry. What they're finding now is very lopsided public opinion on certain questions. For example, one poll showed that by 54% to 38%, people favored repealing SB 5, which is the big collective bargaining bill that restrains unions in a lot of ways. Meanwhile, the governor, being very associated with SB 5 and that whole effort, is seeing his poll numbers go down very dramatically too. One poll showed that if the race for governor was rerun today, Kasich would lose by about 25 points. And, you know, everybody will always say, well, they're only polls and we don't pay much attention to them. But they pay attention to them. They are not pleased and they are taking note. It's just clear that they've got an uphill battle.
What do you think the campaign landscape is going to look like surrounding Senate Bill 5 if it is indeed an uphill battle?
Well, there's no question but that there will be not only intense interest and a lot of money being spent internally in the state, but there will be money coming in from outside the state. The national unions are very focused on this. Both political parties are focused on it. The Chamber of Commerce and other business groups are focused on it. The Democrats see an attempt to weaken public employee unions as an attempt to weaken their political base. If you decrease the number of people who are in public employee unions, you shrink the donor base. And so the stakes are very, very high here. It goes way beyond Ohio.
I'd like to touch a moment on legislation at the State House that will change Ohio's election laws. Both versions in the House and the Senate, for example, shorten the early voting period, the need for an entire Social Security number, if that's how voters prove their identity, and stopping the unsolicited absentee ballot applications. Supporters of the changes say it will streamline the voting process and help avoid fraud, but you have a different take on that.
Well, it's interesting. The House version of the bill shortened early voting to just 1 week. And I think that just this really surprised a lot of people, because last time there was very widespread enthusiasm for how early voting was working. The people at the elections board certainly liked it, and the public took to it very eagerly. But there was a widespread view that the period was probably too long. It was 35 days before the election, and that raised a couple of problems, including the fact that voting overlapped with the registration period. So there were a lot of people saying it needs to be shortened to 2 weeks or 3 weeks. When the House shortened it to 1 week, they really surprised a lot of people. And the elections boards, which are, you know, bipartisan in every county and the state have equal numbers of Democrats and Republicans in every county. We're not pushing for that for the most part. They find that early voting saves them more work than it costs them, especially in the urban counties. And so the House and Secretary of State Husted was promoting 2 weeks or a little longer, and that's basically what the Senate finally decided on. And I think at that stage, it's a little less controversial, although still the Democrats voted against it. But it was a big package involving a lot of other issues, too.
Martin, I understand you're retiring from the Dayton Daily News this month.
I am, next Friday.
Well, good luck to you.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
And thank you for being here today. We appreciate that.
And thanks for having me all these times.
That was WYSO's Emily McCord speaking with Martin Gottlieb from the Dayton Daily News. You can find podcasts of Politics Ohio and many of our other programs at our website, wyso.org. June 19th is known to many as Juneteenth, a day that marks the end of African enslavement in the United States. And next weekend, Dayton celebrates Juneteenth with a festival of poetry, music, food, and community in the W.S. McIntosh Memorial Park. WYSO's Sarah Buckingham spoke with festival organizer Angela Birdsong from the Wesley Community Center about what Juneteenth represents.
June 19, 1865, a Union Army general landed in Galveston, Texas. The Civil War had officially ended, but many were going about their business as usual to promote slavery. The general reissued Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation on June 19th. So for 2 years, no one knew that slaves were free. Nobody knew about the emancipation. So it was rededicated, and that became June 19th became Juneteenth.
And tell me a little bit about Dayton's Juneteenth celebration.
Juneteenth started 13 years ago at Wesley Community Center. It has grown in the last couple years to involve the citywide community, not just the local community.
And so how much has it grown in the past few years?
From the local surrounding community, maybe 100, 150 people, to I think last year we had anywhere from 500 to 600 people at the park last year.
What's the atmosphere like or the vibe like at Juneteenth?
Excitement, exhilaration. It's an atmosphere that feels like family, community. It's Friday. June 17th, we start with a freedom breakfast, and that's at Sinclair Community College, Building 12 at 8:30. That breakfast will be a couple hours, and it just is a chance to come together with city officials on a little smaller scale to talk about different issues and to just to inform people about Juneteenth. Then Saturday starts off with a parade from Paul Lawrence Dunbar House. And then from there, the festival will start up with a pouring of libation. And libation is giving honor to the ancestors.
And are there any other Juneteenth traditions like the libation ceremony?
We pour libation, and like I said, libation is giving honor to the ancestors. But drumming is very major. That starts the program. A lot of times it ends the program, but that's the significant part where the drumming makes a difference. This year we'll have McClendon Institute will be a part of the parade, and their part is to bring the parade up. They are giving honor to the ancestors when they do their part in the parade with African dancing and drumming, and then they'll do a piece at the park when they get there. So drumming, libation are major parts, and asking permission from the elders to start the program. The oldest person in the crowd gives permission, and that starts at the park, starts the festival off. So those are some of the things that we celebrate Juneteenth and celebrate African American history.
And why is Juneteenth still significant today?
For me, it is significant because, like the Sankofa bird, if you know your past and your history, you can relate that to the future. You reach back. Reaching back. If people now understood the sacrifice that slaves made throughout the years, and people fighting for freedom, no matter what race that is, and people, all the different nationalities that fight for freedom and a right to live their lives how they want to. I mean, you can use Juneteenth as a stepping stone for people to understand, hey, this is something I need to know about, and how can I apply this into my life every day, my everyday living, my everyday how I treat people, how I look at different people of different nationalities and races. So it's very significant in the community. And that is the reason why we really push for education and to inform the community that people make sacrifices. And we should, that's a part of libation, we should respect those sacrifices and live to our potential.
That was Angela Birdsong speaking with Sarah Buckingham about Dayton's Juneteenth Festival. The celebration begins Saturday, June 18th at 11 a.m. with a parade from the Paul Lawrence Dunbar House and continues through the 19th at W.S. McIntosh Memorial Park. You're listening to Why So Weekend. I'm Juliette Frumholt sitting in for Jerry Kenny. On Tuesday, Living on Earth featured a rebroadcast of a profile of Mayor Washauer's symphony, Living, Breathing Earth, by Yellow Springs-based producer Eileen LeBlanc. The symphony is coming out on CD, and earlier this week I sat down with LeBlanc to talk about the music and a local connection with the Dayton Philharmonic.
I knew Mayor Warshauer in Wilmington, North Carolina, and I was at WHQR there. She and her family went way back with the Wilmington Symphony Orchestra, and I was an arts reporter in Wilmington. And so it was natural that I was going to do pieces about composers there. So she did a piece called As the Waters Cover the Sea. And it was the first time I ever even interviewed a composer, and I was a little intimidated by it. So we did that in Wilmington, and she lived in Wilmington then, and then she moved to South Carolina. She teaches at Columbia, in Columbia, South Carolina. And Neil Gittleman had been a guest conductor at the South Carolina Philharmonic, so he knew of her. So he commissioned a work back in 1998 or so to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the creation of the State of Israel. And so she did a work back then, and so she did that in Dayton. So then years later, it came along, and this, he was looking for something, and so he calls her to commission this work, which she calls Living, Breathing Earth. And so that's how, this happened, she calls me and says, oh, well, why don't we do something on public radio about this work? And so I said, you know, Living on Earth is a natural place for this because it's all about Mayera's love for the environment, and it's an interpretation of the sounds that she hears, and she writes that into the music, and so it's a full symphonic piece of our earth, and so that's how it all kind of came about originally.
And tell me about some of those sounds that she interpreted.
Well, she started out by just recording sounds in her backyard. And being now that we're in kind of a summer in this part of the country, if you can imagine being in the mid-90s on a daily basis for quite a few months, as it is in Wilmington, North Carolina, and add to that 90-plus humidity. Okay, that's what we lived with. That's what she loved. I actually loved it, too. You have to learn to live with that kind of oppressive heat. But she just loved it, and she loved the sounds of it. So she was recording the cicadas, the mosquitoes, the sounds of the oppressive summer heat. And that's where she started with this symphony, was the call of the cicadas, which you can hear the actual recording that she made and then how she interprets that into the music.
And when you did the piece for Living on Earth, what was the response? Were people saying that this was pretty revolutionary, what she was doing? Or
I don't know. I mean, all the feedback that we had was extremely positive, and everybody wanted a CD. And Living on Earth got a lot of response, and the questions were, how do we get this CD? And the answer came back, there isn't one. So the reason that this was brought out is that now she has this CD that's just being released, and so they rebroadcast this concert. And so now people can go and get a CD if they want to. And Living on Earth thought that that would be a good reason to bring it back out, because it was very positively received in the first place. And it was received well in Dayton. I attended the concert when it premiered here, and it was an amazing thing. Some of it is, if you know what she's doing with the music, it's really very interesting and fun. If you don't, some of it sounds a little quirky. Some of it is extremely melodic and extremely full and moving. But when you're listening for those sounds of the cicadas and the sounds of nature, it's a little quirky. You know, it's not Beethoven.
Now, this piece was originally commissioned a few years ago, and your piece aired on Living on Earth a few years ago, and it was re-aired this week, and the CD is coming out. Do you feel like the idea of nature and music being combined is still a very relevant issue as it was when the piece first came
out? I think even more so, don't you? People do interpret nature into their work quite often, and certainly artists do. Oh, and it's really kind of neat, because what we did this time to fill this out was I got the idea to do a slideshow. The composer Meir Warschauer got me images. A friend of hers is a painter, and so she sent me different paintings. So we actually have a painter who is interpreting this work in a different way. They're not realistic paintings. So we go back and forth from realism, the real shots of everything, her backyard and the river, to these works of just beautiful color and fantasy. And we use those in different places. It's the butterflies along the side of the river. And you can almost see that in these paintings now. So there's a whole other dimension to it. So we have the interpretation of the nature in the music and in the painting, and then, you know, we kind of put them all together with this more recent release.
Do you have a particular favorite part of the symphony?
The piece on the Towaya River, you can just imagine and see in your mind when you hear it. You can see the piece of the river with the banks that are dark, and the river's not moving. It's just not the Mad River. It's a slow, peaceful river, and yet you get this vast, powerful feeling at the same time. So that's one of my most favorite parts. My other favorite part, this is called Living, Breathing Earth. And the last movement, and I'm kind of interpreting this for her. She would probably sit here and maybe say something different because it's her music. But you can hear the orchestra breathing. It surges and goes back, the whole orchestra. And it's like the earth breathing at that point. And it's just, and it builds to this wonderful kind of crescendo at the end that then dissolves into another peaceful passage. And it's just quite beautiful. I've worked with this piece of music over the past couple of months over and over and over again, as you know, when you're putting slideshows together. And I never get tired of it. And even though I might be done working on a section, I sit and listen to the rest of the movement because it just feels good.
can find Eileen LeBlanc's slideshows for Living, Breathing Earth on our website, wyso.org. Living on Earth airs Tuesday nights at 11. The spring season of the Moth Radio Hour ended last week, and there's a brand new show on Sundays at 11 p.m., starting tonight. Here's Sarah Buckingham to tell us more.
WTF with Mark Maron starts tonight on WYSO. WTF began as a podcast, and Mark Maron was producing it in his garage. He's a comedian, and he interviews other comedians, like Louis C.K., Margaret Cho, Ben Stiller, and Janine Garofalo. Here's a clip from Maron's conversation with comedian and filmmaker Judd Apatow.
You know, I'll tell you, Harry Shearer said something to me that, I just to get your opinion on it. He said the reason people are comedians is that it's to have control over why people laugh at you.
I've looked at it this way. When someone is laughing, I know they don't dislike me. I don't know if they like me, but I know in that moment they don't dislike me.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's why, you know, I get, you know, the need for constant approval. Because if you're smiling, I know you don't hate me. I don't know if it's positive, but it's not in the negative.
The Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org, has helped turn the WTF podcast into a radio show. And you can hear it on WYSO each Sunday night at 11, starting tonight. Tune in for the full interview with Apatow. Sensitive listeners be advised, WTF contains adult language, adult topics, and adult themes. Oh, and before I go, I want to share what the host of This American Life has to say about WTF.
This is Ira Glass. I was listening to this podcast a while back, and they had the filmmaker Judd Apatow come on. He was playing these interviews that he did back when he was a teenager with all of his comedy heroes back then, including a very young Jerry Seinfeld and Jay Leno. And I thought, we should have done this. Fresh Air should have done this. Why isn't this podcast on public radio? Well, now it is.
Every Sunday night at 11 p.m. on WYSO.
You've been listening to WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Juliet Frumholt. Jerry Kenny will be back next week. This week's episode featured music from Living, Breathing Earth by Mayara Washour on Navona Records. Our theme music was composed by Magnolia Boldhead. Stay tuned. The Book Nook with Vic McCunis is up next on member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at wyso.org. Broadcasting in HD, WYSO is a service of Antioch University for the Miami Valley.